Well, hey, welcome, everybody. I hope you're doing great. Thanks again for the feedback and the questions and responses you sent. They really help guide me in some of the discussion and especially some of the examples. Anything before we go on mute and start the seminar, anything you'd like to discuss or clarify from last time? Do you have a good understanding of at least this approach to regulating states of mind and a way to do that with clients? Are there any questions about that? That was not a good example of a simple, specific question of 10 words or less that I harp on each of you who train with me to do with your clients. So keep that in mind. Do like I say, okay, not like I do. Any questions or discussions that you'd like to have as we begin? Clarifications? One of the questions I received that I realized may have been just a little bit unclear, perhaps, is when you work with the neuroconditioning chart to look at a way of getting an awareness of an emotional trigger and the recognition of how that creates a state change to immediately enter the responses of column two, the things in the time capsule, the negative self-talk, the state of mind that may be a little bit off balance, to recognize that as quickly as possible, to get grounded and centered, and to have a mantra. The mantra may be the same for all triggers, but you want a distinct ideal response for a specific trigger, because as you go through the recognition, the grounding and centering, and then responding ideally to a pre-planned response or behavior, when you do that enough, it will automatically rewire your brain. So that's why it's called a neural conditioning, a neural conditioning chart. So that's a way, when you repeat it, that you can ultimately do that self-directed neuroplasticity. So anything that you want to talk about or ask or clarify before we start with our material for this seminar? Well, I'm going to forge ahead then. I'll put us on lecture mode so you don't have to manage the background, and I'll reserve some time at the end for discussion and for questions. So jot down anything you want to chat about. Okay, we're going to talk about the neuroscience of peak performance to really apply some of the things we began to discuss to apply that to specifically optimizing your performance. First, let's talk about a confidence blueprint. Olympic gold medalist Nuruddin Morceli of Algeria said, "When I race, my mind is full of doubts. Who will finish second? Who will finish third?" Dr. Din Cooley, a medical colleague of mine in Houston, offered his version. "When you're asked to name the top three surgeons in the world, you should have trouble thinking of the other two." Now, maybe those examples go a little bit beyond confidence, not hubris, but a little bit, but they worked for these two people. Neuroscience does show that the state of mind of confidence is more correlated with success than competence or expertise or skill. Confidence is a state of mind. It's both art and neuroscience, and initiates access to the mindset containing the necessary skills established by deliberate practice. Here's an illustration. David Scott Yeager assigned 44 seventh grade students to write an essay about a personal hero. The teachers marked the essays and provided written feedback. The researchers divided the essays randomly into two piles. On one, they added a generic note in the teacher's handwriting saying, I'm giving you these comments so you'll have feedback on your paper. Can't get much more generic than that. The essays in the second pile received a note saying, I'm giving you these comments because I have very high expectations and know you can reach them. For those students who received the generic note, 40% revised their papers. For the students who received the encouraging high expectation notes, almost 80% revised their papers and made more than twice as many corrections as the first group. Confidence as a state of mind is contagious. What the two responses did in that study is to establish the framework of a state of mind of expectation. Beliefs are a feeling of certainty about what something means. When you have certainty, your brain will find a way. This is now demonstrated, what I'm about to say, this is now demonstrated in neuroscience, and I think it's huge, and I think it's the major thing that we need to think about as coaches in agreeing to work with somebody. Belief in someone transforms a state of mind in the recipient to a more creative, integrative state. Now, parents have known this for some time, but sometimes it takes a while for psychology, cognitive research, and experience to really catch up with that. Belief in someone transforms a state of mind in the recipient to a more creative, integrative state. And that has been my response when I'm asked, what's the most important thing that we can do or be or give our clients? Believe in them. So I would say work only with someone in whom you totally believe. Now, success most often has to do with two things: the state of mind of confidence that we engage in endeavor, and how we manage an optimum performance state, especially under pressure-inducing circumstances. Confidence is a belief that you can create a successful outcome through your actions. It's initially subjective, an emotional regard of a promise that you then live into. It's an internal sense that I can make this work. Optimism is the belief everything's going to work out, but confidence projects competence in a number of studies of practicing experts and their recommendations. Let's apply the neuroconditioning chart now to create an optimum state of confidence. Rather than starting with a negative emotional state or trigger, start with a positive one. And I want to give you a personal example, especially today, the anniversary of this 10 years ago. My daughter wanted me to join her to run in the Boston Marathon with her from the days that she was in college there. She wanted me to join her at Boston College and for us to run together the last 7 miles to the finish line. And she had to learn how hard it was to qualify for the marathon with sponsorship and time. You didn't just show up or send in your name. Well, she finally, it took her a while. She got her doctorate, moved back to Boston to practice, and it became a reality when she qualified and obtained sponsorship. Now, for me, I was excited and horrified, sort of blended. While I'm a lifetime athlete, distance running is absolutely not my thing. It's always been in relation to some ball, usually. I knew I'd have to develop some way to sustain focus and tolerate the rigors and pain of training for us to cross the finish line together. That was my goal. One of my favorite sayings is, fate whispered to the warrior, you cannot withstand the storm. The warrior whispered back, I am the storm. Each time, basically each day in training, when I would have otherwise quit early, or rationalized about stopping because of pain, that mantra, I am the storm, sustained my effort. Many I am the storms later, we crossed the finish line shoulder to shoulder. Now, how does this actually work? The brain chemistry that establishes optimum confidence is led by serotonin, the neurochemical messenger that helps us remain calm and make rational decisions. Confidence establishes ample serotonin in the prefrontal cortex, the command center of the brain, for rational thought and decision-making. In brain chemistry, there's an inverse ratio of stress and confidence. You know this in your experience. With psychological threat and anxiety, the challenge then is to regulate state of mind to maintain serotonin to sustain confidence. Another transmitter directly affects confidence is oxytocin. This, as you know, is the neurotransmitter mediating bonding and connection and fosters an internal mindset of confidence. This connection can be important and for an internal ideal as well as others. Now, here's a related application. Neuroscience research shows that the first words spoken in a conversation trigger a neurochemical reaction in the listener to boot up a specific mindset. That mindset then processes the remainder of the conversation to determine meaning and significance. Now, this is huge for any leader from business to sports to parenting to mentor coaching. A conversation that begins with remarks perceived as authoritative, critical, or adversarial activates the brain defensive circuitry of fight, flight, or freeze mediated by stress chemicals, cortisol, and adrenaline. The listener experiences some degree of guardedness or distrust and may close down a bit for self-protection. These first few words boot up the entire subsequent conversation mode from that mindset. Now, consider, on the other hand, a conversation that begins in a collaborative mode activates oxytocin, the brain's neurochemical system relating to bonding and connection. The initial perception is of a collaborative, trusting discussion, inducing a desire to listen and collaborate without judgment, to pay full attention, and frames the remainder of the conversation. This is exactly what we do in mentor coaching. This is our framework, a collaborative framework. Trust develops with openness to further collaboration to optimize performance and results. Building confidence demands hard work, risk, persistence, even tolerating failure. Gaining confidence regularly means going outside a comfort zone and tolerating setbacks with determination and resilience. Comfortable and confident are not prerequisites for the result of effective engagement. That can be a limiting assumption, a contingency that doesn't work, that you will do it when you get confident. So, how can you prime your mind and brain to prepare for an anticipated situation and establish a mindset of confidence? Well, here's how not to do it. By yelling at his point guard for missing that wide-open teammate in the corner, a coach probably ensured that it would happen again. That was Alexander Wolfe in Sports Illustrated. And this is the most common challenge I see in working with professional and college coaches. They know what every player on that court or then that arena or field need to do, and they want to tell them what to do. It's just that it doesn't work. So to get them to ask a question instead of giving the answer, that's tough. A common perception is the best way to get employees or players or other executives to perform is by pointing out mistakes or being threatening or being intense. While negative emotions grab attention, a positive focus works considerably better to develop confidence as a mindset and the associated aspects of loyalty, bonding, personal development, and also commitment to a group. Priming of mind and brain to prepare for an anticipated situation establishes the foundation of a mindset of confidence. There are seven strategies or seven steps for this priming. They're in your outline. Have some way to access this state, maybe a mantra for grounding and centering. Perhaps ask yourself a positive, powerful question to induce serotonin. Maybe recall or even visualize a successful accomplishment of a similar challenge. Identify moments of significant confidence, a feeling of, I can do it, or whatever it takes. perhaps focus on connections with others who are important to you to activate that oxytocin response, especially in a group, an organization, a team. Create a mental imagery of success to live into, and then also cultivate a support circle of people and mentors. Now, think about how essentially simple it is in meditation to focus on one thing. This is a model of focus, to focus on your breath, to give full attention to that focus. When your mind wanders, which it will, or you have a thought, you simply let it go and move back to your point of focus on your breathing. When your mind wanders again, refocus again. Keep doing this, and your focus and attention will become easier. Being aware of this process is being aware of awareness. This selective attention aligns the energy field of your brain. Now, this is something that you will see in your outline, the mindfulness meditation exercise. And I want to do a little bit of a preface to this to continue a couple of things about developing meaningful conversations before we leave that. People have more comfort and confidence to go further when they carry the best parts of the past forward. There's a whole discipline that I don't think we've applied nearly enough in coaching. It's called appreciative inquiry. I became very familiar with it when Dr. Diana Whitney, the founder, was a guest in my mastermind group. Here's an example of what she emphasizes to focus on what works, enhances what works, to ask what you want more of rather than problems and barriers. Studies by Dr. David Copperwriter found that in consultation with organizations, going in to half of the organizations to do a usual consultative focus, focusing on problems, and people began talking about solving problems, which is what consultants do. The question launches a story. The other groups, he asked about successful possibilities, about challenges, about opportunities. Then that group got significantly more advanced and practical applications for creating new ways to proceed. So how you engage establishes a context. If you tell someone something, you're going to get pushback because whatever you tell, information, a fact, a belief, there's already information, a fact, and a belief in the recipient's brain. So immediately they're going to juxtapose what they believe to see if it fits. If it fits, they're going to find ways to confirm it, confirmation bias. If it doesn't fit, they're going to find ways to refute it. So they actually become more entrenched in their original position when you do this. It's called the boomerang effect. When you instead ask a question, that's when you have a beginning of a collaborative response because there's no pushback possible with that. People will commit to what they help create. This is exactly what we do in coaching. So, now back to the application to mindfulness training and peak practice. When Phil Jackson introduced mindfulness meditation after taking over as head coach of the Chicago Bulls, they won 6 NBA championships. Then, as coach of the LA Lakers, he again introduced mindfulness meditation. They won 5 NBA championships. In a study in the Journal of Cognitive Enhancement, researchers at University of Miami found that expert athletes who practice mindfulness meditation for simply 12 to 15 minutes a day were more able to withstand emotional and mental demands of physical training, had greater resilience, more sustained focus. There are other studies show how there's an enhanced immune system and a number of other health related aspects, but I want to focus really on performance. The essential simplicity of meditation is to focus on one thing. This is exactly what we do in coaching and asking the client, what would you like to focus on? And then where would you like to get to? That's the map, the mindset, and the destination. Now, as you perhaps practice that mindfulness meditation, you might want to think about how you can use that to benefit how you get through the day. There have been studies, for example, that have shown that if we do a 6-minute period of unfocus each hour, especially doing cognitive work, that this can enhance by up to 60% our effectiveness the next hour. The highest percentage is taking a walk in nature. Next highest, 40%, is looking outside at nature. Dr. Sereni Pillay did a lot of this research, and in Boston he had to look out the window a lot because it was a long winter there. He and I have collaborated about this, and there are many other aspects of this kind of practice and performance that can enhance the restoration. To rest, we know from physical exercise, athletes know this, that rest is a part of practice. It's not taking a break. It's not being lazy. It's a necessary part because the body has to restore. This is simply a way of restoring mental energy and stamina. So here now, let's look at some tools for deliberate practice. Question. Are you getting better at the things you most care about? Or are you not improving much at things that matter to you despite spending a lot of time working hard on them? The prevailing theory for decades was that experience was the key to expertise. The more somebody practiced, the more expert they became. 10,000 hours to develop significant expertise. Yet compelling research now shows that we don't gain expertise from experience alone. Dr. Anders Ericsson spent his professional lifetime studying the elements of expertise of experts as they became experts. He studied the art and science of how someone practices to become expert, what they do to perform exceptionally. The answer is deliberate practice. That's a system. We're going to talk about that. Research reveals that after the initial couple of years in a profession, performance can plateau. This is usually a result of movement away from time in the learning zone, we're going to come to that, and more time on just performing. For example, older and more experienced physicians paradoxically can often perform worse than younger, less experienced colleagues. You would expect just the opposite. The reason for this documented finding initially isn't obvious. While the younger physicians have received more current knowledge and training in school, continuing education of experienced physicians should bridge that gap, and the gap should be further widened by the years of experience in the trenches. But this isn't the case. What's missing, we know now, is deliberate practice. A conclusion reached by Ericsson and his colleagues is that, with few exceptions, people don't gain experience from experience alone. Experience, in other words, doesn't make an expert. How someone practices informs how they perform. The vast majority of learning and growing occurs during practice, not during performance. Intense focus on crafting a specific goal with openness for input from a mentor coach is significantly more effective than just massive repetition with regular practice. With artists, intellectuals, athletes, consistent findings are that neither experience nor practice was the crucial variable. Deliberate practice was. Expertise is not about the total number of hours of practice or experience, but the type of practice that fills those hours. For example, the number of years of practice have no correlation with how successful a clinical psychologist is with his or her patients. In a number of instances, significant expertise, such as physics professors and practicing physicians, do not do as well as newcomers in those areas. Repetition of the same experience is different from deliberate practice focused on improving. In fact, practice can make you worse. Every shot that misses its mark makes your aim worse. This is the neuroscience of deliberate practice, the creation of muscle. And think about the applications for what you're doing, whether working out, mentor coaching, engaging in revising the patterns of a relationship. Think about the application for you. The creation of muscle memory is a process of myelinization, to look at the physical aspect, of rewiring your brain as well. Repetition of specific skills rewires so that each time, over and over, it becomes faster, easier, smoother. The drawback is a skill performed in the wrong way can become hardwired. The solution is not to try harder, but to try differently. For example, to approach a barrier from a different direction, such as to work with a teacher or a coach, someone who's familiar with the obstacles and can suggest ways to overcome them. So these are four simple ways to change a behavior. Focus on the system, not just the goals. Determine the mindset and behaviors to get there. Develop a specific stepwise plan, and then ultimately incorporate that as a new identity to make the change permanent. So there are two challenges in changing any behavior. The mind inclines to create certainty by repetition of the known outcome. This is a bias to want immediate closure and predictability. This is what happens when you know, as a coach, the second question you need to ask is, after you ask what you want to focus on, is where would you like to get to at the end of, what would you like to take away from this conversation? But the client says something that you immediately foreclose on that content and forget to ask where the client wants to get to. So you're operating without a map. The other is the brain has rewired repeated behavior and has an error detection mechanism that alerts to anything other than repetition of the familiar. Any change, even good, error detection mechanism says this isn't what I expect. So let's look now at the learning zone and the performance zone. The characteristics of elite performers in business, sports, various endeavors are all similar. All start with mindset. We have two distinct mindsets and processes associated, a learning zone and a performance zone. In a learning zone, the goal is to improve, to concentrate on what you want to master, expect to make mistakes, and learn from them, a growth mindset. Deliberate practice occurs in the learning zone, not the performance zone. In the performance zone, the goal is to do something as best as possible, to execute what's been practiced, to not work on improving, to not think about it even. The learning zone maximizes growth and future performance. The performance zone maximizes immediate performance. Research on the deliberate practice mindset shows that anyone can improve with the right approach. If you're not improving, it doesn't mean that you lack basic talent, but it may be because you're not practicing in the best way. You need to tweak your system. Deliberate practice, in highly oversimplified terms, focus on a specific skill to improve on, specify a specific goal for that practice, not just getting better, that's vague, abstract. Determine the challenge just beyond your comfort zone for that specific practice segment. Use feedback with repetitions to adjust what you do. And as part of that, engage the guidance of a skilled coach or mentor to correct mistakes and introduce new possibilities. And here's the key. Practice does not make perfect. Practice makes permanent. Practice of a slightly incorrect skill sequence will result in permanent etching of that incorrect, because that's the brain's job description. If you practice, if you repeat, the brain's going to etch it as permanent. The right kind of practice, carried out over a sufficient period of time, leads to improvement. Deliberate practice is significantly more important in performance than predefined talent or ability. There are huge studies, significant books on this subject, and that's just a summary of a whole bunch of stuff, to put it scientifically. Deliberate practice always pushes a comfort zone, employing a growth mindset of moving beyond the comfortable repetition. Improvement always resides just beyond the present comfort zone. So look at the outline for the 7 framework principles to develop significant skills with deliberate practice. Those 7 steps become a system for deliberate practice. And I would highly recommend them. Just summarizing them right now wouldn't really implant them, but look at them, work with them, and think about how you might use these 7 principles in your coaching work with clients. Here's an example of an application of that. New York Times multiple bestseller Jeanine Roth, whose work I admire, who's a buddy of mine, was an expert content contributor in my mastermind group. I learned something about her I never knew before. In response to one of the questions about writing her books, Jeanine revealed that she never lets any writing be seen by anyone until she's done at least 30 edits. Each edit improves, refines, focuses. And part of this process, I've been involved in that as a reader and a feedbacker, she gets feedback from some pretty savvy people in the world, mentors, coaches who can offer expert advice. That's part of deliberate practice. Now, let's look at what happens in the brain with deliberate practice that makes it useful. 100 CEOs were interviewed by Accenture to determine the skills needed for executive success. Of 14 abilities that were crystallized from these interviews, one particular ability summarized these characteristics: self-awareness. It's the foundation of all deliberate practice. To know to ask is half the answer. To be able to reflect on oneself and performance requires the ability to be attuned to all levels of self and performance, to incorporate the flexibility of taking in new information in order to change. Self-awareness is a particular systems understanding of the self, to look at the same time, actually, subjectively and objectively at your patterns of emotion, behavior, and attachment to others, including communication. These are all hardwired, so you'll have to pay attention to really, really become aware. The ability to see oneself, to recognize patterns, and think systematically are important aspects of understanding your own dynamics first, then the dynamics of others, which can be immensely helpful in what we do. A component of deliberate practice is developing a corresponding mental representation of the specific process and structure of outstanding performance. A mental representation, a schema, allows you to see patterns and live into them. What you do with mental representations and with deliberate practice is to develop patterns in your brain, schemas that cluster together around some specific performance, and form the foundation of an internal model that is incorporated as part of identity. And that's what makes it permanent. That's what makes it natural, where you don't have to think about it. You enter the performance zone, you do it automatically, hardwire it, and the patterns become ideally flexible and accessible, and they become part of a natural ability of execution. So, 5 questions to ask for each performance goal you set. And you might think about, do any of these apply, or does this apply for any of your clients? Is your goal specific? Is your goal measurable? Is it positive? Instead of, I want to avoid, or I want to lose weight. Is your goal inspiring to you? And is your goal obvious? Would that, we're achieving that goal, be a behavior that we can observe? The central purpose of deliberate practice is to develop mental representations that organize the execution of skills. Deliberate practice is designed to make these representations improve over time. Now, let's shift a focus here with this question. Do you remember a specific moment in a performance that you did, or an outstanding play you executed? Peak experiences are personal moments of lasting positive impact, an exciting and fulfilling high point of an instance that may be unusually intense and meaningful. These flashbulb moments of personal high points of exciting and fulfilling experiences can serve as an example, a positive representation, a highlight for an entire set of experiences. They can serve as an organizer and a motivator for other performance-based activities. Now, peak experiences, like peak performances, are most likely to occur in a state of flow, that immersion in a state of mind and engagement, a sustained state of mind that allows access to everything you need that you do. If it's working with a client, you are 100% focused, immersed in that conversation, not stopping to think about, am I asking the right question? Or in the execution of a skill developed in deliberate practice. Flow is simply described as being in the zone. It's an ideal mental state for executing an activity. Flow is in itself rewarding and pleasurable. Elite performances have trained to be able to make the right decision at the right time without thinking about it. For example, a soccer goalie intercepts an incoming shot in a nanosecond of response. A race car driver accelerates precisely at the instance of a cornering turn. I've worked actually in mentor coaching with 2 race car drivers who describe this experience but have difficulty in deconstructing the elements of exactly how they do it, which is exactly expectable. The link between perception and action, the time between seeing and doing, is instantaneous and precisely formed. I've seen the fastest land animal, a cheetah in Africa, run at an amazing speed and be able to instantaneously, barely perceptible by human my human vision, shift course in order to avoid an obstacle or pursue a prey. The unconscious pattern development is installed by deliberate practice. So that's what we strive for. This is a way to deconstruct how we go about learning that and the elements of that. I want to emphasize something that we only have learned about recently. I'm going to save the last shot for maybe discussion. I'm going to add 15-20 minutes on to the end of our last seminar just for discussion, for question and answer, because this is more of a personal experience and less on the principle. So I'm going to go back to what's important for us to focus on here. I want to talk about unlearning, because that's something we often don't talk about enough in coaching. Now, here's an example. A few of you I know have heard this story before, but I think it's a premier example not only of unlearning, but also of charts architecture. Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. Each day, the subjects picked a different option from polls of contrasting behavior: lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive. They would pick one and behaved accordingly for the entire day. So an introverted person, for example, would act as an extrovert for the entire day. Additionally, twice weekly, they were asked to behave in a way outside their usual life pattern, to eat something they had never eaten before twice a week, and to read something they had never read before twice a week. Now, what do you think the biggest finding was after 4 months? This baffled the research group for a while. The subjects lost an average of 11 pounds. 6 months later, almost all had kept the weight off. Most continued to lose weight. Now, they were baffled because this was not a weight loss or dietary study. It wasn't about it. It focused on change and its impact. What they found helps us, I think, in coaching. Requiring people to change routine behavior makes them actually think about decisions rather than habitually choosing a default mode without consideration. In other words, what they did was to think about each thing they ate, for example, as a choice at that moment. That's exactly what we ask our clients to do, to look at that choice and how they may have selected it. They also, most of them, began to even apply that to each bite. For each bite, they would ask, is this in my best interest? So instead of just mindlessly eating, as most of us do, to take 2 or 3 bites and then have a conversation or begin thinking about something until our plate, they made each bite a piece of choice architecture. So the brain changes when we learn something new. Each step of learning at the same time involves an unlearning. And think about the application here. Why is it much easier for a child to learn a foreign language? The beginner's mind is the essence of this process of not having to forget or unlearn something to replace it with the newly acquired, but simply to learn something new. Now, inevitably, however, much must be unlearned in order to replace it with the new, like forming a new habit when one already exists because the brain already has that pathway. Learning is not the simple acquisition of information, as we just discussed, but of a practiced behavior introduced with much already existing behavior already in the place that needs to go. And some may be specifically in contrast to the new learning. So, doing a slightly different forehand, a slightly different stance in tennis, is not as easy as seeing it instructed and adopting the moves. Responding in a slightly different attachment pattern when your partner says something predictable that usually sets you off. A combination of learning and unlearning. Such ingrained attachment patterns are played out in all of our stories, life, professional, business. A habit simply means that you have by repetition rewired your brain to make a particular behavior or thought pattern automatic with specific cues. And once a habit's in place, it's an anatomical reality in your brain with the neuronal pathways and networks that execute it. And simply presenting an alternative or a better pattern doesn't overwrite the programming already in your brain. Change can occur, but it's a process of doing a new behavior and undoing the one that it replaces. These are the neural substrates of learning of skills, whether physical or cognitive. Now, a habit engages software created for a past experience. If it's useful, it can tremendously expedite a default and effortless execution. If it's no longer useful and outdated, then a new behavior pattern needs to be created. So, a simple strategy becomes not to fight old habits, but that engages them, but rather to start new ones. All the associations ultimately of the past habit are then instantly replaced by an immersion in the current new experience. Now, the challenge is our habits have become invisible to us, so we have to become mindful of our choices and of the active process of choice in everything we do. We have to keep unlearning just as we keep learning to convert the mindlessness of automaticity into the mindfulness of change. So these are important aspects, and this is something I think that you'll find helpful. This is the simplest way that I can think of, and this is based on some really good research, who's coined this term and developed it. A colleague, a sort of a buddy of mine, Jeffrey Swartz at UCLA. This is self-directed neuroplasticity. What do you want to do when you change your mind and brain? Well, there are three really simple steps. Let's say that there's something that's repeating, like negative self-talk, or repetitively going to something or doing something you don't want. It's automatic. You automatically have negative self-talk, let's say. So the first thing that you can do, there are three steps. Whenever you're presented with something new, have a instantaneous crisis of confidence, say you can't do it, or have some other negative self-talk, recognize what you just did and thought as an error message from your brain, because your brain is doing its job description, repeating in order supposedly to protect you from, you know, having a bad experience. So recognize the error detection mechanism. Recognize the error of that statement from your brain. Reframe it as a false brain message to focus on what you do want. This is what we do in coaching all the time, to focus on the challenge, the opportunity, as a framework, and then to focus on the next steps, on the systematic way to do it. So recognize the error message from your brain and whatever negative ideas, self-talk, lack of confidence, reframe it to a positive, current focus, not figuring out what happened in the past to get it there, and refocus on the next step and steps. When we unlearn connections and association, we weaken those chemical connections, also neuroplasticity, just in the opposite direction. This unlearning is necessary in our neural networks to create room for new connections. The combination of strengthening some connections, learning, while weakening others, unlearning, keep our neural networks from overload. So this pruning of the old unused pathways occurs 60%, 60% of it occurs in our sleep. This is how, when we wake up from a good night's sleep, we're able to think more clearly and quickly. That's the importance of sleep, but that's not what we're about, but keep that in mind. Also, keep in mind two things. Some problems are better avoided than solved. And this is related to the other statement, and this comes from Jung. Some problems you can't solve, you just have to outlive. So we're going to go into the how-to on this in the third seminar and incorporate the roadmap system in a strategic way to deconstruct and understand personal performance, to systematically write new code for mind, brain, and behavior to perform under pressure. So that's a précis of coming attractions. So here's a final aspect that I want to present to you. And some of you have heard me tell a couple of the simple studies that fostered some focus on this. Now, if you were to take a test on paper, 8 pages in length, the paper is 8 pages, you're going to take a test on the content. Which of these methods do you think would result in the greatest success? Reading those 8 pages 4 times in a row and trying to memorize what you can from them. Or reading the 8 pages once, putting down the paper, and writing a 1-page summary. Just once. Research shows that the second strategy of putting knowledge into action results in a 50% greater success. When an output channel is mobilized in the brain, it creates new neuronal networks and pathways to begin rewiring with the new information to complete the brain cycle. The most immediate result becomes a higher memory retrieval. Repeated findings by a lot of different investigators show that this type of targeted effort involves active reconstruction of what's learned, and it can increase learning on average tenfold. In other words, it's the antithesis of passive learning. You take what you learn and you create your own story around it, your own schema, and you've made it accessible, retrievable, but you've made it yours as well as completing the circuitry in your brain, all the same thing. Routine practice includes mental rehearsals. Performers such as Michael Phelps and American aerialist Emily Cook write scripts of how a perfect performance looks and feels. Cook told the New York Times how she wrote entire scripts of what a perfect jump would look and feel like, and how she would replay the script into a recorder, then play the recorder with her eyes closed. These levels of deliberate practice include mental and physical combinations of execution. All performance expertise involves deliberate practice consistently developed through an output channel. There are no purely motor skills or purely cognitive skills. It's an intricate synthesis of learning and expression. Only in recent time have neuroscientists been able to see the mechanisms of the actual structure building of the cells that wrap more myelin around the fibers that fire. The more the nerve fiber fires, the more myelin wraps around it, so the faster and more effectively the signals travel. The process builds skill-specific broadband capacity in the central nervous system. Optimization of this process involves a feedback loop to monitor, compare, assist, and revise responses. Self-reflection, in other words. Cognitive skills like reading and vocabulary, as well as other mental and physical skill development, stimulates this myelin growth. So, practice, rather than making perfect, makes myelin. And when practice is deliberate, specific skills develop and become hardwired. Every skill is a form of memory, physical and mental. And every form of memory is enhanced by focused, systematic practice. And I know some of you have heard me speak of this story. Canadian researchers at the University of Waterloo showed that people learn better by expressing what they're learning, by speaking, dancing, or singing out loud to improve long-term memory. They had two groups, matched groups, read the same passage in a book, one out loud, one to themselves silently, then took a test. The ones who read it out loud did 40% better on the test. So no matter how much we acquire information, study and learn, it's by putting it into action, this output channel, that we enhance effectiveness and create a performance memory. Putting something in an output channel brings together both sides of the brain, simply put, the emotional and cognitive, that allows greater synthesis and connectedness with expression. This process facilitates both attention and retention. It makes it your story. This is also why, at the end of a coaching session, for example, you want the client to briefly summarize in at least a sentence what they've gleaned from this session and then what they're going to do to put it in action, what they commit to do before you meet again. A body in motion tends to stay in motion. A body at rest tends to stay at rest. That's how we're wired. That's also why we're useful human beings as coaches. You have to have a plan and a strategy for change. The brain hardwires what we repeatedly do, good or bad, and when we attempt to change, it resists, also why we're paid very well, and the error detection mechanism activates to say this isn't what's expected. The brain error detection mechanism alerts to anything other than a repetition of the familiar. This is always what we have to keep in mind in working with our clients to empathically resonate with them, to help them get an accurate reading of this discomfort, of taking a new step beyond where they've been before. This is not their intuition telling them it's the wrong thing. It's not their gut saying they made a mistake. This is simply the way their mind and brain works, and they can develop that awareness and capacity when you do it empathically with them so that they can do it more and more themselves and develop this self-function. We're in discussion mode now. I'm interested to hear any thoughts or ideas, clarifications, questions, anything about this material. Is it making sense to you? And does it seem workable for your purposes and application?
David, good evening. This is Kibidoni. I wanted to ask you about this applied to music and music teaching, about the rewiring of this self-reflection of what you're learning and putting this knowledge in practice. My question is, does the student and the professor, do they have this conversation before the teaching, or is this something that should just flow and just do it without telling the student?
Okay, that's a good question, and I want to answer simply for right now, and I want to give you a reference. The reference is, this is exactly how Anders Ericsson began to think about the whole area of peak performance and deliberate practice. He did a study in the premier music school in Berlin and spent an immense amount of time there, he and his team, to have some remarkable findings and developed the idea of deliberate practice there. So I'd suggest look at his book and just read about that. So to answer your question more specifically, it's not about giving information or facts or even a kind of overview of what someone should do. It's really developing. Let me mention, I've forgotten whether I included this example in the first. When Angela Duckworth, the author of Grit, came to Ericsson and said, I've been running for tens of years, but I've never gotten any better. So he didn't begin with any explanation of all of his immense expertise. He asked her five simple questions. And those questions were, each time when you run, do you have a specific goal? Do you work on a specific aspect? Do you go just beyond your comfort? And he went through a number of questions. And the last question was, do you work with a coach to help you run? Her answer to all of those was, no, I don't. He said, I think I know why you're not improving. It's that you're not practicing right. Because each of those were an aspect, as he knew them to be, of deliberate practice, of look at those aspects in your outline, because that's my better and more organized answer. Because nothing about this will make as much difference as going through the experience. Now, here's one exception to think about, but this doesn't replace that other example. When someone is wanting to grasp something, they need to have a concept of what they're grasping. Now, this is obvious when you're working on a skill, when you're working on music, but let me give you the simplest example, which I'm a fan of. If you give someone 10, and I think you can apply this to music probably better than I can. I'm applying it to laundry, so that tells you the difference between you and me. if you give someone a list of 10 things to remember, and you give them a list, you give a matched group 10 things to remember, but you tell that group that these things all have to do with doing laundry. The group that has an organizer for these quick 10 things that they're given, they do 60% better on memory retrieval after a period of time because they have a schema to organize it. So when you're doing work with someone, I assume this applies in music as well. When you're looking at the schema and the idea and doing it collaboratively, you're doing deliberate practice toward a goal, and the purpose is also in mind. Now, does that help, and does that apply to your question specifically?
Perfect. Thank you so much, David. Thank you for everything.
Yeah. And look at that study. I think you'll really enjoy it if you haven't. There was also a question a guy responded and deferred gentlemanly to. Go ahead, please.
Dave, this is Kip.
Hey, Kip, how are you, my man?
Hey, I'm doing great, thanks.
Great to hear from you. What you got? You should be teaching this.
Does deliberate practice increase the neurogenesis in the hippocampus?
It's involved, but the hippocampus is the midbrain component that's more involved with creativity and memory. So it's involved indirectly. And you're familiar with the studies that show that when creativity and memory are both tweaked, that the hippocampus expands. With exercise, it increases 100%. With creative engagement, it increases significantly. And when it doesn't, then it goes the other direction. And with chronic stress, there are less number of cells. So what we do to work out, I work out for my hippocampus, you know, not my abs anymore. But when you work out regularly, your hippocampus almost doubles in size. It's the center of creativity and new learning. So it's involved in memory, new learning. So it's very related because that's part of the input channel.
Okay,
so it's an organizer for the process of deliberate practice, not the performance, but the practice component, if that makes sense.
Okay, thank you.
Does that, truly, Kip, does that make sense? There were too many words.
Yeah, I'll take every neuron I can get.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, I'm going to hang up so you can get back on that treadmill. Okay, thanks very much. I know we're a couple minutes over. Remember, if there are questions and things we don't get to, I'll add some time on to our last seminar so we can have just a kind of a fireside chat. We'll pick up right here next time, especially look at the roadmap and at stress mastery tools. So I look forward to that. Again, if there are any questions, comments, or things you want to highlight, fire me an email. Thanks very, very much. I hope it was useful, and I look forward to picking up right here next time. See you guys. Bye now.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
See ya.
Bye.
See ya.
Thank you.